Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join two exciting voices in speculative fiction, M.H. Ayind and Marv Anson, and Chair Sarah Shafi, as they delve into the craft of world building, from creating magic systems and futuristic technology to developing languages and rich cultural traditions. Recorded live at the 2025 festival in partnership with Future Worlds Prize, this conversation explores how authors shape vivid fictional worlds that captivate readers and reflect real-world complexities.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. Thank you for spending your Sunday lunchtime with us. My name is Sarah Shafi. I'm a journalist and an editor, and I'm also co-chair of Future Worlds Prize, which is a prize for SFF writers of colour. We're here today to talk about crafting other worlds, how you write convincing worlds in mostly in SFF, but a lot of what our writers will say will apply to all sorts of fiction. We'll chat for about half an hour or so, and then I'm really keen to throw it open to audience questions. So if there's anything you want to know about the world of writing, please do ask our two writers, who I will introduce now. M.H. Ayind was winner of the 2021 Future Worlds Prize, and she's the author of the Sunday Times bestselling A Song of Legends Lost, which is the first in her epic fantasy trilogy, and it was published in April. And Marv Anson was a finalist for Future Worlds Prize 2023. Her debut fantasy novel, Firstborn of the Sun, which she will be talking about today, is out in October this year. So you have a little while to wait, but I'm hoping we'll give you a good enough teaser that you don't mind the wait. So welcome both of you, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Sarah.
So I'll get you to start just by giving us a sort of quick elevator pitch for your books, just so the audience knows sort of where you're coming from and kind of what sort of world building you'll be talking about. So, Madhupe, tell us a little bit about A Song of Legends Lost.
This is the bit where I think I should have prepared my elevator pitch. A Song of Legends Lost is an epic fantasy novel. It's written in the tradition of the sort of 80s and 90s epic fantasies that some of us grew up reading. And it is set in a secondary fantasy world where the nobility can summon their ancestors to fight in battle. It's multi-POV. And it is thematically about rebellion and colonialism.
Lovely. Marv, tell us about Firstborn of the Sun. Marv has made notes, so.
I have made notes. I will read it and then I'll just kind of summarize as well. So, Firstborn of the Sun. On the night of a great blood moon, six children were born to a man. Nearly two decades later, the mysteries of that night still haunt the kingdom. Which one of them was born first, which was born to die, which of them will rule. In this old tale of myth and magic with laws and ancient spells, the kingdom of Oru seeks the one who will sit the gilded throne. So it's epic fantasy. It's inspired by Yoruba culture. So it pulls on a lot of myths and histories and a lot of political intrigue in, you know, situations where like the king has, you know, more than one wife and there's like many children and exactly what they said, actually.
So I'd love to hear about where you began when you were building these stories. So was it with a character? Was it with sort of a moment or a scene that has made it into the book? Was it a setting that came to you first? I mean, Madhupe, let's talk to you because I know perhaps you could explain, because I know you've been writing in the world of this is your first published novel, yeah. But you've been writing in this world for quite a while.
Yeah, I'm not even going to say how long. Probably it's longer than you've been alive. But yeah, it's a long time. In terms of where I start, I mean, it's easier for me to think about how I start with, say, short fiction, because I've written a fair amount of short fiction as well. Most of it is also fantasy, and some of it is set in secondary fantasy worlds. Usually I have a combination of things. So because I do love world building, it's one of my favourite parts of the process, I do usually have a scenario. What if we were in a world like such and such? My worlds tend to be, it would usually be some kind of political or cultural difference from our own world. So I will have a what if there was a world where such and such could happen.
So what was the what if for this book?
Oh my God. a lot of different things. I always say that these books are inspired by the Final Fantasy series of video games. So what if we were in a world where you could summon monsters, but actually they were your ancestors? So that's part of it. And also the other part of it was, what if we were in a world where technology was treated the way we treat artifacts from ancient history, something mysterious from a bygone era? Those were the two sort of what ifs for me. So I do have a what if the world was like this, but I also do usually have a scenario or starting point in terms of a set of events, something like that. That's how it would be for me.
Marv, are you similar, or where did Firstborn of the Sun begin? Was it with the sort of the magic idea, the kingdoms, the characters?
I think I start with characters. So usually I would see a scene, and that would be, I would try to build a story around the scene that I've kind of, I'm saying seen too many times, envisioned. But for Firstborn of the Sun, it actually came to me on a flight, and I think it was the Magic Fest. So I was flying back home over the Sahara, and I had seen lots of ice, lots of snow-capped mountains to be specific, and lots of ice kind of rolling down them over the sands. Since then, I've realized that this is something that happens really frequently. But at the time, I just could not understand it, because I just thought, surely it should have melted by now. This is midday. And there's something about how elements can't change their nature, you know, in nature. So like ice would always melt with heat. Sands would always be hot in the sun. And somehow I just thought that these elements that couldn't change their nature had somehow found this balance. So obviously it probably was cold on the ground or whatever. Did not get off the plane to find out. However, I found it just so magical and fantastical that this has happened. And I thought, the sentence in my mind was, if elements that can't change their nature could manage to find a way to be in balance, how much more like humans? And so that's what I was trying to do with giving humans the kind of extreme cold and, you know, extreme heat as magical powers, and trying to get them to fit over each other in the way that I thought this balance had happened. And that was my kind of original idea. And as I started to fill in both sides of the camps with people, it got a lot more complicated, and it's unlikely that I ever reached that balance I was trying to get. However, it is fun trying to get to that journey.
It's interesting with both of you, and Marv, you sort of mentioned there at the end, as you began to explore the world, that's when the people game. And it's interesting that it's for you, both of you, the ideas and the sort of the place, however nebulous that place was, came first, and then you put the people or the creatures into it. I just find that really fascinating way of sort of approaching things, because I think we can often think, oh, a character came fully formed to a writer, and that doesn't really seem to be the case that often, I don't think.
No, it definitely wasn't, because I had to, you know, I basically just split it into like the Ice Kingdom and Hot Heat Kingdom to keep it simple. And I needed to find the conflict there, because there needed to be one. And so I had to create this character. And so part of the blurb for the book is, in this kingdom, everyone has the energy of the sun, except our main character, who has the opposite of that. And so that had to be her, that turned out rather to be her source of conflict. But it was really interesting, because when I first thought of her, I thought she would be like everyone else. And then by the time I split her up to be, okay, she's the only one who's not like this, then I had to build a lore around why it would be a problem for her to exist in this place. And, you know, now we have 160,000 words in book one. and that's just from trying to fit enough conflict within this one character's life.
I think because we are products of our environment, once you have the sort of core of the world, like with your elemental settings and so on, once you have that, the rest comes. And I feel like world building is at its best when it's an ongoing process. So you've got the sort of foundational idea, and then you build off that. And you might have, say, what you were saying, like character traits. Like, I know my character is like quick to anger or something like that. But you, I don't feel that I know them until I put them in the setting and see how that setting affects them as an individual and what they do from there. And then other elements of, you know, what you were saying about the conflict and so on, those things come in as you start thinking, well, if the world was like this, what would, you know, the people in power look like? What would the people who are less privileged look like? And so on and so forth.
So how much of the world do you build before you can get to that point where you can drop someone in and say, if they were from this place, they would have these experiences, and therefore if they went over there, they'd react in that way? I mean, you love a bit of world building, you said. So like, are you kind of quite into setting up your world before you start the sort of individual stories?
Yeah, I mean, I always mention every time I speak spreadsheets. I love a spreadsheet. I do, it is something I enjoy, and I will try to figure out many aspects of how the world works beforehand. But what I've come to realize and what I now do is make sure none of that is actually set in stone, because it needs to adapt to like how people would actually behave, which I can't, other writers can, but personally I can't know until I start watching what the characters are doing. And also elements of conflict about the world that I maybe hadn't anticipated that will come up as I write. So I will have a lot of detail beforehand because I like detail and it's fun, but I am very prepared to like scrap it all and go with what I think logic would be once I start exploring the world.
Yeah, I don't have too much in stone, like you've said. I like to think of the broader ideas. And so when I, with Firstborn of the Sun, for example, I have an idea of, you know, the inciting incident in book one is that she goes to save her friend and then she realizes she has powers that no one else should know and everyone can see it now. So that's a scene that I had known from the moment I created that character. And so everything up until that point was just writing to get her to that point. But I allowed for everything to happen. So like the father figure she has, the best friend she has, the people in her life, everything that makes her like feel, you know, immersive as a character, like that feel like a person, all of that happens when I start writing. I just know that I'm trying to get to the point where she has to be in this temple and show these powers to, I don't even know who she's showing it to, like all the people who will gasp at it and try to arrest her, all of them are created as she gets to that point, because then I'm thinking, who is this going to be a big deal for, you know, why should they care?
How important is it for you as writers to be able to be flexible and sort of agile in that way? I think I remember sort of seeing some advice about writer's block and sort of some people saying that for them, if they've got writer's block, it's because the character is doing the wrong thing and they're like too bogged down in trying to get them to a specific place instead of saying, actually, we can go this way, for example.
Yeah. I mean, for me, flexibility is really important. Part of that is because I think I get bored quite easily. So if I don't have the spontaneity of being surprised while I'm creating, I think my brain, part of my brain switches off a little bit. Part of it is just because, again, of the type of writer that I am, whereby I don't feel that I can replicate authentic feelings and reactions in advance. I need to be in the moment to see how they work. In terms of how important it is, for me, that spontaneity is really important, and I try to build in as much as I can now. But I think that that's not the case for all writers. Some are not like that. And also, it does mean things take longer. So I chuck away a lot of words. So
the first book was like 168,000. Yeah. So how many words did you throw away?
Oh, my gosh. You don't even want to know. Many books, let's just say books worth of words were thrown away.
None of it's a waste, because I guess either you use it somewhere later down the line, yeah, or it all is there to get you to that core story.
Yeah, and I will always like cannibalize the bits that I like even if it's just say a turn of phrase. And yeah, nothing is wasted. So yeah, so long as you're prepared to throw away lots, then for me, that's a great way of writing. But it does, the other side of it is it does take longer. So people who are writing to a very tight deadline, I don't think always have that luxury of being able to explore. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I think being flexible is the only way to get out of a writer's block, because it means that you need to force yourself out of where you are, either quite physically or consuming different forms of media, doing something that is different, or considering how, you know, when people say things like the character is not doing what I want them to do, it just means that you've built a character that the action you're writing for them is inauthentic to the kind of character traits that you've given them previously. And of course, there's room for growth. So usually where I tend to slow down is where my character is having an arc and they're having to change from their original version, and more like they need to grow, obviously, but just like, you know, changing when you're a regular person, it is still hard regardless of the fact that it needs to happen. And so understanding how that will how that slope will go while they remain authentic to the general blueprint. So there needs to be huge flexibility. And also as a writer, just as a person existing, your experiences change you every day. So if you're, say, writing a story about grief and you go to a funeral on Monday, by Tuesday, you write something different that you would have written on Sunday. And that's just as a result of being right there in the face of it. And so when you consider that the minute you walk out of your house, the minute you wake up, everything you're experiencing is influencing what you're trying to say. And you're finding different ways, better ways to say it. And so if you're trying to hold on to, say, the notes you had from last year, you're no longer that person. And so your brain is basically saying, we can do better, we can do better. And then it tends to be a writer's block because you're struggling to accept that this has to change.
One thing that sort of amazes me about the both of you is how you've spoken about your writing, but then you're also somehow creating these amazing stories that are multi-POV. And I don't mean like you've got two characters that we're hearing from, like we're both hearing from, like, from both of you, from like half a dozen or so characters each, and there are many, many more in them. How do you, when you're crafting a story, how do you keep track of everyone and sort of be like, well, if X is there, they don't know Y is doing this, but they can see Z is like doing this and that's affecting them in whatever way. Like, what's your method for keeping track of everyone and where they are in your world?
I use my point of view characters to world build. So to explain or to let the reader know what's happening. And because, you know, it's secondary world, and in Firstborn, there are few, the political rules are different from how we have it. So like things like the rules of inheritance and ascension to the throne and things like that. And so because it is different, I try to make sure that anything I consider to be complex as a world building strategy or anything like that, I explain it through two different point of views. So it gives me the opportunity to explain the same thing twice, but using two different point of views means that I can explain it in a way that you don't feel you're reading the same thing twice, but I'm explaining it twice. So like I have like a prince and I have an assassin. If they both explain the same thing, which they do in the book, you won't feel like you're reading it twice, but you will. It will help you to understand the world a bit better. So that's one of my hacks for having more than one point of view. So I have four in this one. Another thing is I also want to, because of how epic and in scale the world is and how many things are happening, I love when the reader knows things that, you know, other characters don't know. So sometimes you do need a spreadsheet to be like, this is what they know, and at what point do they interact? Because when the characters interact as well, you need to decide how much they know about each other, how much the reader knows about them, and how much they're allowed to say to each other, because that influences where the story goes. Because there will always be one kind of primary character, and all the information, so Laura is my main character, and I need to make sure that she's not in the same room as someone who can tell her something she's not supposed to know. So one of the point of view characters, for example, is Alawani, who's her best friend. He probably has, out of the 42 chapters, he has four. And this is intentional because he knows a lot more than she does. And it's almost like cheating if you're in the mind of someone who knows something the reader should know and you don't tell them. It feels inauthentic that way. So I had to intentionally keep him off the page just so we don't get to know the things that he does until the end. And then I fill it up with other characters who don't know as much as he does, but are still there to cause enough conflict.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I was thinking about one of the characters who is introduced very, very, very late in book one of my trilogy. He has some points of view in the second book. And originally there weren't any because I didn't want to introduce another character. I've already got loads. But I did put some points of view for this character in. And I said to my editor, is it all right? It's the same as what you said, it's four chapters, or actually it's three. And she said to me, oh, I think it's fine because this character has a lot of power. And what you were saying, you don't want to see too much of them. So yeah, that's interesting to hear that from someone else as well. And then in terms of keeping track, for me, I write by character all the way through, or by location. So I will do one character's arc all the way through.
I couldn't do that.
So I don't, here's where the chaos comes. So I do, when I say I write one character's arc all the way through, what I do is I'll write until I hit a roadblock. Not writer's block so much, but just how am I going to get this person there? I feel like they should be there. I can't figure out how, or this feels wrong. And I can't feel what I should do right. Then I'll switch to another character, do the same thing until I get stuck. Then I might go back to the first one. But I write them in silos, so to speak. If it's so for example, in book two, a lot of action takes place in one setting, but there are two characters there, then I will write the characters together. But I do those things separately. Then I do what I now know is called reverse outlining. I didn't have that terminology when I started doing it. So then I will go through each chapter, write down the key things that have happened. And then when I come to put everything together, I will look at the sort of inconsistencies you were talking about, like, oh, well, why this character knows this bit, but should they know that yet? And how does the fact that this character has done this affect that person? So once I've got the outline and I can look very clearly at the individual points, that's when I bring everything together, so to speak.
That's incredible.
That's not, okay.
Mom was like, what are you doing?
So much work.
I don't necessarily recommend it. It depends how much you enjoy chaos.
No. I don't like to. I know sometimes you have to lose words, but I try to not. So yeah. I couldn't write like 200,000 words and like lose 100. I would die.
Yeah.
So I write chronologically, and this means that I am a bit slower, but I write chapter one and chapter two. And, you know, people say sometimes to not go back to edit. It is good advice, however, I do go back to edit. So if I remember something, and this is because my world is building out chapter by chapter and scene by scene. So I don't know who's going to be in that scene with that character in chapter five until I've reached chapter 1-4, because I kind of create my side characters as I go as well. And sometimes I use it as a motivation to myself. So if I can see, say, chapter 10 very clearly and I know what's going to happen to it, but I'm in 8, I'm like, okay, that's the reward for going through 8 and 9.
Yeah.
And so I would stop. Sometimes I will have a writer's block just for that moment, not for the chapter after, but just for that one that I'm in. But I do stick with it because I feel like I need to build it gradually and sequentially as well.
Yeah.
I'm not able to write out of place. For example, I know how book three is going to end. I could write the end of it today, but I don't know who's going to...
Not allowing yourself.
Yeah, I'm not allowing myself to. I'm like, I don't know who's going to be alive by the end of it. So I know what I want to happen, but I don't know what characters are still going to be there by the time I get there. So yeah, I just keep it in my head. And anything I forget, I'm like, then it wasn't worth it.
We're going to go to audience questions in about 5 or 10 minutes. So just to prepare you all, I wanted to talk about some of the nitty gritty of both your books. So I'm really interested in how you decide on sort of language in your novels, because I think both have sort of quite distinct things, both when you might listen to the books or kind of as you're reading them, but also the way things look on the page. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the influences on the sort of language you choose to use in the books and how that contributes to the world that you're building and the world that, importantly, the readers are kind of learning about as well, I think, because there's nothing like reading a sentence on a page that looks like, let's say, patois, to kind of bring you right into understanding a person or where they might have come from.
Mm. So by language, are you thinking sort of word choice elements?
Word choice, and also I think Madupe in your book, sort of one of the characters in one of the POVs, we get lots of like, is it square brackets? We get like lots of kind of stuff with thoughts or speech presented in different ways as well, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, there are characters from different sort of strata of socioeconomics in the world. So they will talk differently. That was quite important to me. One of the things that was important to me was to have people from this world's equivalent of working class backgrounds with agency and being important to the story. And I wanted them to sound like me or, you know, how I speak when I'm comfortable and not thinking about making sure I say T's properly and things. So, yeah, so certainly I would think about the background of the character in terms of their individual word choice. Then some of the other language in the book, because this world is based on a number of pre-colonial cultures, including Yoruba culture, but much more loosely than Marv's book, and a number of other cultures that have influenced me in my life or that I wanted to draw upon. And then I picked certain specific words from those places, a few, and then words that to me sounded like the languages that are from those parts of the world. And I have, you know, if you're making words up, you do have to be careful, like I do. I did try to make sure any word I made up, I sort of had a little Google to make
that,
sure.
I mean, I've always wondered about that. Is it a case of like having a really thorough Google to check that
it doesn't mean
something else? Yeah.
It means but in this language. Yeah, I mean, I try to make, I'm a very pedantic person, and I think with one or two exceptions, and I'm thinking, I hope this doesn't mean but in someone's language, but I do try to check each one. And I won't, obviously you can't, you know, check every word in every language, but the part of the world that that particular word, the part of the world that was inspired that culture, I'll try to make sure it doesn't mean anything inappropriate in that language. So yeah, I think a combination of things for me, and certainly trying to tie the language used to the type of characters. And then you're referring to square brackets, which I use for characters you can speak into other characters' heads. For me, the brackets imply like closed off, so that's why I chose it. That's some of what went into my decision making.
So my books, because it's really heavily inspired by Yoruba culture, there's lots of Yoruba in it. So the entire cast, you know, is Yoruba. I have imagined it as a world where the Yoruba Empire continued to expand without the influence of colonization. And I treat the reader as someone who is kind of visiting this world, and you're almost like peeking into what they're doing and listening that way. So ideally, the entire book would be in Yoruba, but I write it in English, and I try to make sure that all of the proverbs are still in Yoruba so that you can see. So even though it's written in English, the characters are speaking Yoruba to each other. And so there will be times where I would write that Yoruba on the page and translate it either in action directly or in context. And my epigraphs at the start of each chapter also has like a proverb, because Yoruba people speak in proverbs quite a lot. So I have that.
Are all the proverbs you have heard? Oh, or yeah. You've made up as
no,
well?
No, there's enough to go around. There's like millions of them. So no, I haven't. Maybe I should try making up one, but no, there's enough. So I have those there. And then within breaking down where people live as well, within the capital city, I have some of them speaking Pidgin, which is like a version of Patois. And I have that just because it's reminiscent of like, say, Lagos in Nigeria, where it's a bubbling city where everyone comes together. They have their own languages, but they speak this common Pidgin that is familiar to everyone else. So that way, if you learn this language, you don't have to learn my own language, because we can both speak this, but it's not English and it's not Yoruba. So a middle ground there, I thought would help to show it's also a very fast-paced language. It's very, very active. And so I thought putting that in the capital, where it would give an idea of how fast-paced it is when compared to other kind of cities within the same kingdom, which, you know, I thought was cool.
One thing in your book, Marvin, this sort of, I think, connects to what you've just been talking about, is stylistically, like, you have accents on letters, which I think until a few years ago we really wouldn't have seen. Like, that was something that just didn't, unless it was like a German umlaut or something, like, unless it was a Eurocentric language, we wouldn't have seen accents on letters like that. How important was that to you in terms of both as a writer and for the world building and for the reader as well, to have to like contend with perhaps versions of letters that they've not seen before necessarily?
Yeah, it's just Yoruba. So Yoruba, written Yoruba has those accents, and that's because we don't have some alphabets that exist in English. So for example, like your name actually, like Modupe, for example, if you were writing it correctly, or even Ayinde, so the E at the end of Ayinde there will have a dot under it because it's day, which is like A. So someone who reads Yoruba will know how to pronounce it without someone else telling them. So you know how to pronounce it because she's kind of told you, but if you could read Yoruba without the accent, you wouldn't quite figure out. We also have words that have the same spelling but different pronunciations. And so you need those diacritics as well to let you know how to pronounce it. If you're like me and you don't know how to read it, I just go pronouncing every word it could possibly be, and I'm like, yeah, that's the one that sounds right.
That's how a lot of people read as well. Sometimes if you come across an unfamiliar word, you're like, this sounds right in my head and no one else will ever know. So
we had to get like a Yoruba scholar as well to read through, because I told my editor, I'm the worst speaking Yoruba person in my house. So like, if my family knew that you were relying on me to to print this book, they would laugh. So we had to get someone who kind of created a glossary as well. So he's read through the book, picked out every Yoruba word, make sure all the diacritics are correct. I have him on WhatsApp. So like literally when I write at night, usually at like 12 midnight, I'm just like, just confirming that this dot is supposed to be on top and not below and things like that. So yeah, it is great to have the investment from even the publisher to realize that it's really important to write it as it should be written. Whether or not you know how to read it is irrelevant, because the people who do.
Yeah, because it actually doesn't make sense without it. I mean, I don't speak Yoruba, but I know they're different words, because it's a tonal language. The way you say the word makes it a completely different word. And for me, you know, growing up with the dot under my E, which I always used to draw, and my kids as well, they all have Yoruba names, and one of them is very like, oh, that's not my name because it doesn't have the dot, even though he doesn't speak Yoruba either. It's really uplifting to see books written like that now. And also I see people's names on social media now and they have it written correctly like that. Yep. And it really, that's the sort of representation that really matters and is really uplifting to see.
Okay, I think that's a good note to go out to audience questions. So please, put your hand up and we'll get a microphone to you. So just one here.
So it was two main points. The first point was Future World's Prize. Without looking today, I didn't know anything about it. So if I could just get an insight into that, if it's a competition, etc. If so, how can you enter?
Yep.
And the second point is about getting your work out there. So particularly if you're writing other worlds or crafting other worlds, does it come under the fantasy genre? And to the agent, when you're selling that, or when you're giving it, is it usually just the first chapter? And what are some tips you can do? Because I know you talked about making it exciting. What are some tips you can do in order to either spur the reader to continue to the next chapter if it's the first one, or particularly as well draw the agent or whoever you're sending to when writing?
Okay, great. So I'll take the two questions separately. So first, a little bit more about Future Worlds Prize. So I can talk about that. So we're an annual prize. We're open to unpublished writers from the global majority based in the UK and Ireland. And we will open again in October for submissions. So we ask for up to 10,000 words of your manuscript. We're open to all genres of science fiction and fantasy. So witches, wizards, spaceships, dystopias, anything and everything you can think of. And we ask for a cover letter and a synopsis. And you can talk to me afterwards, and if anyone else is interested, I could give you our website address, and that'll have all the info on it. And we shortlist 8 writers every year. All 8 of our writers get mentoring and they get a cash prize, and we have a winner and a runner-up as well. So
it's a really good cash prize. Even if you don't win.
And then I will get Marvin Madipe to answer the other question, which was essentially about sort of how do you talk about your work if you're writing other worlds, and how might you talk about it if you're approaching, let's say, an agent, and some tips on what you would say to an agent and what you would send them.
I think all kind of fantasy science fiction falls under speculative fiction. So that would be like the broadest you can put it in. You can narrow that down to either fantasy or science fiction, or you can even just write it as science fiction and fantasy. So there are many options. When they start reading it, they'll get an idea of it. The narrower you can make it, sometimes the better, because then when agents are reading the submission that you send to them, they want to know, where do you think, so if you walk into Waterstones, what shelf do you think this will be on? So do you think it'll be under general fiction? Do you think it'll be under horror? Do you think it'll be under fantasy? So that shelf is what you're trying to let them know, even from the start, what they should be thinking about. In terms of how much to send to them, it does require a bit of research on the agent that you're thinking of. There's a website called Manuscript Wishlist. There are many agents on there, and then they say exactly what they want. So some people want Usually within the UK, they want 3 chapters, which is quite generous. Sometimes in the US, they want 10 pages, which is a bit harder. Some want 5 pages, which is like insane. But
there's a few that just want a letter as well.
Yeah, some just want a letter. And they're quite pedantic with the rules as well. So if they ask for 1 chapter and they send 3, they might be upset and just not read it because they want you to like follow the rules that they've set. So it's all about kind of following the submission guidelines. For the actual content of the manuscript, I think my first book was a thriller novel, and writing that made me realize that I really like the suspense of novels. Like, even though I'm writing fantasy now, I think I still write like a thriller or a suspense writer. And for me, this means I want there to be a reveal or something. Suspentic is not a word. What?
Suspenseful.
Yeah. Suspenseful. It sounds odd. In the chapter. And so it means you're starting to read the chapter by, one, spacing out the world building. So there's also the tendency to, if you've built up the world and you know it so well, you want the reader to know everything about this world in chapter one, that you should not do that. So when I talked about my reader being, sorry, I'm going on and on, but when I talked about my reader being a guest in the world, it means that my characters are living their lives and you're just seeing them or hearing them talk about it. My characters are not necessarily pausing to explain to you what they're saying before they interact with it. So for example, we came on the train today and you understand what I mean when I say that. But if you were writing a fantasy world, you could be tempted to say, we arrived on the train and the train was created in 1880 and before it was locomotive and it used to be coal and now it's electric. And like all of that information is not necessary because you understand what I mean when I say we rode the train to come here. And so things like that, to strip out information that's not relevant because the characters don't need it. However, if I told you that the train broke down and we had to have a secondary train that was run on coal, that's relevant because then I'm like, oh, this one didn't work. And then this. So it's relevant to what I'm saying to you. So using that to make sure that you strip out too much world building,
yeah,
make sure the suspense is still there. There needs to be a reason why I'm reading it, especially within those first 3 chapters, is really important.
Yeah, I think the main thing is not have to include too much world building in the beginning because it will bog down the opening. Agents talk a lot about hooks. So the hook, the thing that makes you want to read on, I would say focus on that. It is a little bit of a game because once you've gone through the hoops of getting an agent, getting a publisher and so on, you will still be editing your manuscript. So there may be things you can work back in that you feel should be there at a later stage. But I would say focus on forcing whoever is reading this to read on, making them have lots of reasons to want to know what happens next. And then with regard to agents, as well as manuscript wish lists, which Marv mentioned, which is really good, the agents' websites will say their preferences as well. And there's also a site called Query Tracker. Both manuscript wish lists and Query Tracker skew slightly American, but there are more British agents on there, and you can get, I mean, my agent is in the US, so it kind of doesn't matter, but it's just something to be aware of. But there's so much information on there.
Right. There's a question at the back there.
Oh, so it was manuscript wish list, which is where agents can list the things they're looking for, and they also usually put their requirements on there. And then there's one called Query Tracker, which is actually a tool for query. You can basically look up agents in your genre and you can see a lot of statistics. So that's more for finding agents, but I would always recommend going to their website as well and seeing what they say.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us, each of you, a world that has been built by another writer that you would either like to visit and spend some time in, or we would hate to visit some spend some time in?
Oh, I just thought of one more thing, which is to do with genre. Sorry, just to come back to you. When you were saying about what genre you're writing in, I would think about the books you think your book is similar to and then what they're marketed as, and then use that to decide on your genre.
I could just also say maybe you could talk about your own one and whether you would like to be there or not.
I don't think I will do well in any fantasy setting, to be honest. I do quite like the comforts of life. No, I would visit mine maybe for a day, but I would not visit it as someone who does not have powers. So if I got to be in my own fantasy world and I had like the highest, that was the most powerful person, then I'd have a great time. I could do that. Otherwise, no, yeah. It's too hot.
I don't think I want to live in my world. Again, I don't think I'd survive. And I didn't, I don't consider my work to be dark, but I've heard quite a few people say it is dark. I tend to like dark things, and I'm a horror fan as well, so my dark measure is a bit off. But I don't think any of my worlds I create, but if it's not cheating, Star Trek. I would live in the Star Trek universe if I had a fictional universe to live in.
Yeah, no.
Ask me what generation of Star Trek?
What generation of Star Trek?
Picard's era. Thank you for asking me.
Again, if you're not on that bridge and important to whoever's watching, you're going to die in 2 seconds.
I'm not, because there's no money, there's no capitalism, there's no politics.
Come back to Bradford next year for a whole discussion with the new
I'll
about Star Trek worlds and which ones you do best in. Okay, does anyone have another question?
Was there a point in either of the novels where you got stuck, and how did you keep going if there was?
Oh yeah, I get stuck very often, many times in a day. My favorite thing is to just go watch something. So I believe in consuming different forms of media when you're stuck on something. Mm. So either I'm reading a book that is not in the genre that I'm writing, or I'm just watching TV, or you know, taking a walk. The main point is removing yourself from thinking about it too much, because you need to switch perspective. And to do that, you need to almost like scramble your brain and start again. So whatever helps you to scramble, whether it's taking a walk, whether it's watching something else. I used to paint a lot. I'm not good at it, but I really enjoy it. So I do that as a just like wipe the slates clean and then start rebuilding again. And I also don't start from where I got stuck. I start from a little bit before it. So if I'm stuck in chapter 5, I will start reading chapter 4 to like get into the story and then start building to see if I can just push through. Usually you will figure out what the problem is, whether it's the location, whether it's the character, whether there's not enough tension. Because there's the hardest part of writing, I think, is getting the idea in your heart, in your head, which, you know, would feel perfect to you on page to also feel perfect when it's on page. So that transition is what you're struggling with. And it's almost like your subconscious helping you to refine. It's like, nope, that's not what I said. Nope, that's not what I said. Until you get to what the original idea or feeling was like. So when you try to deviate from that in a way that doesn't benefit the story, I feel like just our creative minds are like, no. And then you're trying to open up your mind to other kind of perspectives. And sometimes it comes from just engaging in other forms of art.
Yeah, all of what Mar said, I think. I recommend to people this book called Refuse to Be Done, which is by Matt Bell. I don't know if anyone's heard of it, but it's the sort of plotters' pantsers divide that they say writers fall into. So those that like to plan their work versus those that don't plan so much. This book is written towards people who don't plan so much. I think also helps if you do get stuck, because it's about just getting the idea down. And the way that he talks about doing the initial draft is just writing the key points. And then you would go through, it would be very scrappy. So that's what I tend to do, is I will skip ahead if I'm stuck. I'm like, well, I know this thing that I want to happen, so I'm just going to jump ahead to that. I mean, the danger is what you were talking about earlier, where you have to do things chronologically for them to make sense. The danger is then you create holes for yourself to fix later. But I'm a great advocate for saying that's a future me problem. I'm going to worry about her. She can sort it out. So certainly exercise for me was getting outside. Consuming other media, for me, it will be video games, something really absorbing. Also, something I will do is write something different, work on something different. So I normally have a couple of things going at once, but also not being afraid to skip, so long as that suits your writing style.
Do you ever, when you're sort of writing, particularly, I guess, in the first or sort of the earlier drafts, leave placeholders? So, I mean, both of your books have, like, let's say, intricate fight scenes in them. So do you ever just write fight here and then continue? You do.
So I do. I don't do fight scenes because I love writing fight scenes. I know some people hate them, and I see a lot when people are talking about placeholders, it's often battles, and I'm like, get me to the next battle. It's the bit in between that is difficult. I have it for things like, for example, if I feel that I want to put a simile in, or if I want to have a certain turn of phrase that I can't find the right turn of phrase, sometimes I'll put better simile or cool phrase here, or explain how this happened. So not so much for action. For me, it's more to do with language and speech. But yes, I do that.
No, I don't skip anything at all. And this is, for me, again, it comes back to I feel like I won't know what emotional state my character is in at the end of this thing. So there's a fight that my main character has with one of her mentor figures in the book. And originally, little spoiler, but like I said, there's a surprise in every chapter. Originally, she wasn't meant to kill her, like, because she loves her. But when I was writing it, I was just like, she feels quite desperate. And she is also really impulsive, doesn't know how to control these powers. I feel like she could easily make an accident here. If I had skipped that chapter, then all of the guilt and grief that she feels in the following chapter, which other characters start to recognize and add to their own lore in their own arcs, would not be there. Because in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm coming back, but this woman survives it. Well, in reality, as I wrote it, she did not. And that influences almost the rest of the third act. So I can't bring myself to skip it because I feel like I will miss something, either emotionally or, you know, miss one person who should be dead and write about them and have to remove them later.
I'd definitely be like, fight scene here and then come back to it later. Or something good here and then, yeah.
Whereas I have to make sure mine isn't just all fight scene.
I know you've got a question. Just check, anyone in the middle got a question?
Hi. I was just wondering about self-publishing. One, what are your thoughts on it? Obviously, you know, with regards to getting into places like Waterstones and also with regards to the Future Worlds Prize. And the second question is, if you have a fantasy type fiction that is faith-based, does that still go under, from your experience, the same kind of categories?
So we allow self-publish in terms of the prize. You can't be traditionally published, but self-publishing is fine. And Marv will be able to talk a little bit more about that because Marv has self-published. So
it's really hard. It's possible, but it's hard because, well, to be fair, they're both hard. But with self-publishing, you are like everybody. You are your own marketer, advertiser, edit. Well, you shouldn't be your only editor. You should get an external editor. But you are like a project manager as well as a writer. And so you need to write your draft, finish it, hire an editor. That's really important. And probably a copy editor and then a proofreader, because the more you read it, the less errors you'll be able to see. You need extra eyes anyways. Once all of that is done, you almost need to like take off the writer hat and say, now I'm a publisher. And so that means you're hiring someone to do your cover. You're not thinking, oh, I really like blue. You're thinking, what? You're doing market research and looking for other books in the industry that are like yours and picking elements from there such that when a reader sees your book, they can immediately associate it with something else. And so you can't almost, you need to remove all of the, this is my book and my baby too, this is a business decision. And this is, I'm making decisions so that I can make money from this thing. Like if that's what you want to do anyways. And so it takes on a lot of, there's a lot of business aspects to it that you need to be a decision maker for. And there's a lot more kind of research because it's almost like if you don't do something today, it's not going to get done. But if I don't do something today, like someone on my team would do it, that kind of thing. So you can't quite delegate except if you then start hiring people to do like different bits. And there are some things that you do need to hire people for. One would be getting an editor. That's like the main primary one, just because your competition is traditionally published books because you're coming to the same market. It doesn't matter how you do it. And so, you know, your reader wants to be able to open your book and open a traditional published book and see it as the same product. So they would want to see typos. They would want it to have a coherent plot, the same way they expect that from other books. So, and with Waterstones, so you can upload your manuscript to Amazon or to Ingram Spark. Those are the kind of two ones that would print your book print on demand. With Ingram, if you put it on Ingram, Waterstones will be able to order it. However, the way it works in the UK, they give each store a lot of autonomy. So it depends on the store. They can choose to carry your book and they can choose to not carry your book. I would try your local Waterstones. If they do want to stock your book, if you go through Ingram, they'll be able to order it from a place called Gardner's and then get it in store. However, it is really tricky just because it's up to the store manager.
And your last question was about if an SFF is like a faith-based SFF, where would it sort of fall? It's still SFF. This is where I think what Madupe said about titles like yours make cover. You often hear the publishing industry, particularly agents and publishers, talking about comps, which is basically just comparison titles. So that would be perhaps you in your mind, if you know it's X meets Y and it via, you know, with the what of whatever, then in that way you can encompass sort of all the different elements of the novel. Hope that helps. Question right at the front here.
Hiya. How do you deal with pacing, like introducing the worlds at the beginning of your book? And also, when it comes to backstory, do you agree that it should start off at the beginning or further on in the novel?
How do you mean?
As in, like, would you introduce a backstory of the, like, the person or the world that a character has come from at the beginning, or would you introduce it further on in the novel?
Yeah, for me, I would say with backstory, just tread really lightly. I prefer to pepper it through the story. So a sentence just alluding to something and then build it up gradually, because the minute you take the action away from what is happening in the present, you risk losing the immediacy of what you're doing. I love flashback chapters, but I don't write them myself because I think they're very hard to pull off. But that's another option, as opposed to having, say, paragraphs of this is what happened to this person when they were six or whatever. So I would say leave it as late as possible until you've really caught your reader, because you want them to stay with you. And ideally spread it through things that are happening that maybe remind the character of something that happens, a moment they keep coming back to, say, from a trauma that you can repeat throughout and build upon. Something like that is how I would handle it.
Balancing the world building, I think, was the other question, sort of about how much you might put in at the beginning. Or
yeah, I mean, I always say lightly at the beginning. I don't know how well I do that myself, but that's what I aim for.
Yeah, I agree with that. Weaving it into the story, but also trying to find other ways to get the information across. So I have a storyteller in my book, and he's an old man and he tells stories to kids, and I use him to do a lot of backstory. So that way it feels like I can kind of break up the paragraphs with dialogue, with him saying, you know, sit down, don't stand up, you know, like action is happening now, as well as the story that he's telling. So that's just a way where the reader won't feel like you're giving them like a whole block, because all that scene is for is just to tell you this backstory. But then I'm adding things about the man, I'm adding things about the kids, I'm adding things about the girl who's listening to all of this happening, so that it feels a bit more natural. I give myself a rule of like two paragraphs of like 5 to 6 lines. After that, that's too much. You need to add something, either dialogue or action, change the pace, and then you kind of get another chance. And then, you know, like I mentioned with point of view characters as well, you can use that for backstory. So if one character knows this thing about this other character, we can hear half of it from one character and the other half when the character meets the other person who knows the other half of it. So it's the same information, but you're just breaking up how we hear it or how we read it.
And one more thing really quickly, I would always scrutinise whether that backstory is needed, whether it's the reader needs it or whether it's you that needs it, and trying to differentiate, because sometimes it's actually you that needs that backstory. The reader doesn't necessarily need all the details.
We'll do one last very quick question just here, but I think Marvin Madupe can stick around for a little bit after the event. So if there's anyone, if there's anyone who has a question that they didn't get to ask, please do it then.
Thank you. Just a really quick question. I've noticed that with some of the popular other worlds, such as like your Witcher, Harry Potter, say for instance, Game of Thrones, you have a book, you have a TV series as well. And I'm just thinking, when you're designing, is it worth, other than the structure between a play and a book, is it worth just kind of thinking, right, let me convert, say for instance, or draw some element in the way in which how a play is written, or the way in which how you'd write for a TV and write that into a book and change between different medias in order to create something? Or is it a case of just one's for another, and if it becomes successful, then you can change media, or can you switch between to create something more fluid?
I would say don't do any of it. Just write your book, because especially with TV and film, there are so many people involved in that process. And you have most writers of novels whose work gets adapted have almost no creative involvement whatsoever. Those that do will be with a team of writers. There's a whole writer's room for most TV shows. There'll be so many creative minds with input, and they've got a lot of financial skin in the game that but this is what I meant when I said that is not going to hold up to. You kind of give over most of that when you sell the option of your book. In terms of, but to be more cynical,
there are some books that will be more readily adapted than others. My book, with many big battles and magical things happening, is not going to be adapted. Is less likely to be adapted than, say, a thriller with like no special effects involved. So if you were thinking about which idea should I go with, which is more likely to be picked up by TV, it would be the one that costs them less. But the chances, it's so many things get optioned but never get made. Things get made but then never make it onto the screen. And it's quite a heartbreaking process that I've seen with other writers. So I would say, put that out of your mind, unless you want to write a whole script and that's a separate art, is my advice. I don't know if you guys have,
I think that's a good note to end on. Write the book that you want to write. That is all we have time for. Thank you all so much for coming and for your questions. And as I say, if there's anything you do want to ask, just pop on over or we'll go out into the hallway. But in the meantime, please join me in thanking Marv and Madupe for their time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.